Welcome to the Movement Church Podcast. Our vision is to be a movement of people finding their way back to God. We want to be a place where you can own your faith and take next steps in your relationship with Jesus. Maybe your next step is to seek out community and join a movement group. Maybe it means supporting a movement financially for the first time or using your gifts on a volunteer team. Whatever God is calling you to do, our prayer is that you will step out in faith and let Him lead you. For more information about your next step, please visit movementcolumbus.com.
My name is Sarah, and I'm part of the teaching and research team here at Movement. And we last week finished our series in the Psalms. So if you had been around for maybe some or all of that, we spent our summer in the Psalms, and we looked at a number of different passages examining, you know, who is the Lord? How have people related to God throughout history? And we saw, you know, that there's lots of emotions in life, and sometimes when we come to God, we feel really good about it, and sometimes it seems like God has just completely abandoned us. And one of the things that we saw happen a lot in the Psalms is that sometimes you feel those feelings like within the span of 15 seconds. You feel really good and then also really horrible. And so we spent the summer just kind of reminding ourselves that we're not alone in the way that we come to God, and that the experiences that we're having are not new and unique, that people have experience the good, the bad, and the ugly of life and of trying to draw close to God throughout history. And so Mark wrapped that series up for us last week. We looked at Psalm 139, and next week we're going to start something new, but this week is just kind of a transition in between. And as I was thinking about it, actually, even in between services, I was thinking there are so many things about what we're going to see this morning that are connected to some of these ideas that we saw in the book of Psalms. Because as I reflect on the Psalms, I think one thing that we've seen over and over again is that there is this cry of hope. That no matter what is happening, no matter how many challenges we're facing, that the psalmist is asking us to consider, can we still hope in God? That word, even, is used often. And so I want you to just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And then I want to tell you about another verse that I've been reading just this last week because school started again. I'm a high school teacher. I know none of you who work 12 months out of the year feel sorry for me that I had to go back to work, but I feel sorry for myself. And I teach 10th grade Bible and at Worthington Christian High School, and we're examining some of like the background to who Jesus is right now. And so one of the verses that my students read just this past week, and a number of them were saying like, Ms. Knepper, what? Is this verse out of Psalm 42. And recently, this verse has become very real to me, and I'll tell you why here in a moment. Psalm 42, verse 3 is about the Messiah, okay? So, I'm sorry, not Psalm, Isaiah. In Isaiah, there are all of these prophecies about who the Messiah is going to be, and the Jewish people are waiting for this person to be their deliverer, to be the one who's going to show up and give them freedom. And so many verses about the Messiah are about like how he's going to be this strong deliverer and a conqueror. And then Isaiah 42 verse 3 says, a bruised reed he will not break. And so, you know, my 16-year-olds in my class are like, I don't, like, he loves plants. I don't know. Like, what are we supposed to understand about this? And so we spent some time talking. Okay, now this, I recently, over the last year or so, have started to bring a lot of plants into my house. And I'm not, they like teeter on the edge of life and death basically all the time because I have no idea what I'm doing, okay? So I know that like you should pick particular plants because like they get a lot of light and I have a lot of light in my house or whatever. I just go like, that one's pretty, you know, and I like bring it in and I put it in my house and then I kill it. Like almost invariably they die. So I have quite a few plants in my house right now that are, the best word to describe them would be crunchy, which I think is not like the word that you want to be able to describe your plants as. And also many of them are brown. I was going to bring one of them today, but I was so embarrassed I couldn't. So when I look at these plants, like, I'm constantly thinking, is it time to give up on this one and just throw it away? Or can I revive it? And my method of reviving it is just giving it as much water as possible, which doesn't always work. Sometimes that makes the plants moldy, I've discovered. So anyway, I'm telling you all of this. Some of you maybe can give me some advice afterwards. But I'm telling you all of this because this verse in Psalm 42 has started to take on I have a new understanding of it. Because as I think about the Messiah being someone who looks at a bruised reed, which I think is probably how we could describe most of the plants in my house, he doesn't look at it and say, I'm done with this. Throw it away. Let's start fresh. He doesn't break a bruised reed. The rest of the verse actually says, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. The Messiah was prophesied to be someone who would see those who were bruised, who were on the edge of burnout, and instead of crushing them, he would revive them. Now, with that in mind, this morning what we're going to talk about is hope. And like I said, we've seen this theme a lot in the Psalms. And so this morning, you may walk out of here in a half an hour, and you might think, you know, we didn't really talk about anything new. Actually, a lot of times when I stand up here, that's kind of how I feel. Like, I'm not telling you anything that's, like, new. There's no rocket science being delivered here this morning. But maybe we need to be reminded of the truth of what hope is. I want to read a quote to you about what the essence of hope is. And this quote is by Thomas Aquinas, who was a theologian from hundreds of years ago, and he talks about how hope is a form of desire. You know, when you think about the way that we use the word hope, we often use it in place of, like, you know, I wish. I hope the weather won't be a million degrees again this week. I hope my sixth period class doesn't make me want to jump out a window like they did on Friday. I hope that my, you know, spouse remembers that it's my birthday. I hope that my children behave like normal people and not like monsters. I wish. And yet many times these hopes seem like, what are they based on? Is there any certainty that these things are going to be accomplished? Aquinas said this about hope. Hope is a special form of desire. Unlike fear, the object of hope is good. Unlike joy, whose object is present, the object of hope is in the future. Unlike the desire for small things, the object of hope can be difficult and arduous to obtain. And unlike despair, the object of hope is possible to be attained. It's that last phrase that really captures me. Because when we talk about hope here in this context as followers of Jesus, it is easy for me to begin to feel like hope is something that I'm just crossing my fingers for. I hope this is all going to work out. I hope that Jesus is really going to be for me what I need him to be. I hope the things that I believe about him are true. And so this reminder that hope isn't just crossing my fingers, wishing on a star. Hope in Jesus is a desire for something that it is possible for me to obtain. Now, maybe you're thinking, like, okay, sure, that's easy for you to say, but how can we know that that's true? We're going to look in a couple of places today, and we're going to start in Romans chapter 5, which is page 860 if you're using a Bible around you, Romans chapter 5. And as you turn there this morning, I'm going to just suggest to you our big idea. so that this can be kind of in your mind as we're working through these verses. Our big idea this morning is this: our hope is not found in what we want and wait for. Our hope is found in the fact that we are wanted and waited for. Our hope is not found in what we want and wait for. Our hope is found in the fact that we are wanted and waited for. We're going to start in Romans chapter 5, verse 1. We're going to read a few verses and then we're going to talk through them. Keep this idea in mind as we begin to see what's written here in Romans chapter 5. Romans is a letter that's written to believers during the first century. It's written by this guy named Paul, who wrote lots of letters to Christians at the beginning of the church. And here's what he says to these people. Romans chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, since we have been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ our Lord has done for us. Because of our faith, Christ has brought us into this place of undeserved privilege where we now stand, and we confidently and joyfully look forward to sharing God's glory. Now, before we move forward, let's talk about what's going on here. First of all, Paul says, therefore, since we have been made right in God's sight, depending on the translation that you're reading, this is the NLT, the New Living Translation, but other translations use the word there, justified. Since we have been justified in God's sight. If you're familiar with these ideas, you maybe breeze right past that, but I want us to take just a time out to consider what this means. You have been made right in God's eyes. When he looks at you, if you are a follower of Jesus, he does not see your sin. He does not see the damaged parts of you. He looks at you and sees you as someone who has been made just. We see this idea written about in another one of Paul's letters in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. Paul says, God made Jesus, who never sinned, to become sin on my behalf so that I could become the righteousness of God. Martin Luther called it the great exchange. Jesus takes my sin and I take his righteousness. This is what Paul's referring to in Romans chapter 5, verse 1. You have been made right. If you follow Jesus, when God looks at you, he doesn't see your sin. He sees Jesus' perfect life laid on top of you. This is crazy. You have been made right in God's sight by faith. This is referred to throughout Scripture. That this right standing that I have with the God of the universe has nothing to do with the things that I have done. And again, I think many of you are going like, yes, okay, we know this. I cannot earn my salvation. I've heard it before. There's no giant scales in heaven where God is weighing the good against the bad of my life. You know that in your head, but I wonder how many of us actually live that way. How many of us still have this feeling of shame and guilt that somehow God is looking at us and he's shaking his head and he's saying, you know, I would really like you a whole lot more if you could just keep your act together. I saved you because like you prayed the prayer and so I had to, but I'm not really crazy about you. I'm not too wild about the way that you behave. In fact, when I look at you, all I can think about is this crap that you keep doing. No, men and women, you have been made right in God's sight by your faith. And that faith, all that word means, is that we have looked at Jesus and we have said, I know that I can never be enough on my own. That's the essence of the gospel. The gospel demands humility. The gospel says, I could never earn my way to God. It doesn't matter how many good things I do and how many bad things I avoid, I will always fall short. But Jesus showed up. Jesus lived a life in the place of the life that I could not live, and he died a death to pay the penalty that I should have paid. That is the gospel. And he raised to new life
so that I can participate in this with him. I have been made right in God's sight through the faith that I have that I'm not enough, but Jesus is. Now, already, I kind of feel like we could just go home there, but we're going to keep going. Because of this, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ, our Lord, has done for us. We could spend a long time talking about what it means to have peace with God, but we're going to keep moving. Because of our faith, Christ has brought us into this place of undeserved privilege where we now stand. That phrase, undeserved privilege, the Greek word there is actually in reference to grace. We now stand in grace. Grace means that you're getting something that you haven't earned. You don't deserve it. If you're a parent and you have children, this is like literally everything that you give to your kids. Maybe some of you even say that. Like, oh, you want to be grumpy about the food that I'm giving you? Who paid for it? Me. It's my food. You don't want to eat it? Fine. Eat nothing. Oh, you want to be grumpy about the room that you sleep in? You know whose room that is? It's my room. I let you live here. Undeserved privilege. We stand in grace, not because we've earned it, but because he's given us this gift. And then verse 2 concludes this way: we confidently and joyfully look forward to sharing God's glory. Now, the phrase confidently and joyfully look forward is actually the Greek word hope. So this brings us back to this idea that Aquinas was suggesting to us, that hope is a desire for something that I can actually obtain. It's something in the future, but it's something that is not just like, oh, I hope it comes together. It's something that I feel confident of, that I'm waiting for with joy, with expectation, that it's not here yet, but I know it's coming. Now, at this moment, it's like Paul realizes, oh, maybe I should explain to you how do we get this hope? How do you feel this confidence and this joy as we wait? So he moves on to verses 3 and 4, and it seems like there should almost be parentheses around these two verses. It's like an afterthought, a side note. Hey, by the way, here's how we get to hope. So let's read these together, verses 3 and 4. We can rejoice too when we run into problems and trials, for we know that they help us to develop endurance. And endurance develops strength of character, and character strengthens our confident hope of salvation. If you want to get to hope, you have to go through difficulty. Now, I don't love this. I will be honest with you. If I could have written the story, I would have written it differently. But I think Paul knows what he's talking about. If I want to get to hope, I have to go through things that are hard. Because when I go through things that are hard, it develops an endurance inside of me. I can't develop endurance when things are easy. I can't. I have to push myself to the place where this has now gotten challenging. The best example that I can give to you, I am no athlete, okay? Like, I played field hockey in high school, but I only played because I went to a Christian school, and so, like, if you wanted to play, you got to be on the team. But I run some now, and again, I am no, you know, whatever. But here's what I've learned. My lungs and my legs only get stronger when I go further than I've gone before, or when I go faster than I've gone before. Like, if I keep running the same route, the same distance, the same pace, that's fine, but nothing about me is changing. I'm not getting stronger. I'm keeping my muscles and my lungs at the same level that they've always been. But when I push myself an extra mile or at a faster pace, now, usually when that's happening, I want to be vomiting the whole time, okay? I'm just telling you. Like I said, I'm not an athlete. I'm a big faker. But when I get to the end of that run, something has developed in me. And as I continue to do that, I increase my endurance. I can run further than I could a month ago if I continue to push myself this way. The same thing is true in our spiritual lives. When I go through things that are hard, it develops an endurance in me. And then Paul says, and you know what that endurance is doing? It's shaping your character. Because no longer are you a person who gives up when you hit something hard. No longer are you a person who falls into despair when things get difficult. Because you're able to reflect on your circumstances and you say, no, you know what? I've gone through something like this before. I've done the long run before where I thought I was absolutely going to die at the end of it, and you know what happened? I didn't die. So if I didn't die before, I think I could probably do it again. The difficulty develops an endurance that begins to shape your character. And then Paul says, and you know what your shaped character leads you to? It leads you to hope. Because as your character has been shaped by finding endurance through difficulty, you realize, oh, we're not headed for despair. You realize there's light at the end of this tunnel. You realize we're moving in a direction, and I don't have to throw my hands up in the air and say, this is all going to fall to pieces. No, my trajectory is beginning to shape me and show me there is hope. But now the question is, what is this hope based on? Because if you look at the very first sentence of verse 5, it's a little bit alarming. This hope does not disappoint us. That's a bold statement. Because we live in a world of disappointment. Some of you have already been disappointed today. You're disappointed by how much road rage you felt driving here. You're disappointed by how insane your children were this morning. You're disappointed that there was no more Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I don't know. We live in a world of disappointment. And yet Paul is saying the hope that is being like developed inside of you will not disappoint us. How is this possible? I want us to look at a story because I think that this story illustrates the hope. And then we'll come back and we'll read just a few more verses in Romans chapter 5. This story is found in John 20, which is page 828 if you're using a Bible here. Let me set the story up for you and then we'll read a few verses. At this point, Jesus has been arrested, put on trial, and crucified, and he's been buried. So he's been in the tomb for a few days. And we're going to pick the story up when some women have gone to visit the tomb. These women include Mary, which is Jesus's mom, and another woman that we think is probably Jesus's aunt. And then another woman named Mary, who we sometimes call Mary Magdalene or Mary of Magdala. She's a woman who has been a follower of Jesus for quite some time. And the kind of event that caused her to follow Jesus was that he healed her of these spirits that were tormenting and possessing her. He changed her life completely, brought her out of darkness into light. So she has committed her life to following this man Jesus. She believes he has life and truth and goodness inside of him. In fact, she's so faithful to following him that when Jesus is put to death, she's there watching. Now, that might not seem remarkable to you, but let me remind you that most of Jesus' followers had bailed. We only have record that Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and John, the disciple of his followers, that those were the only ones who were there. Mary Magdalene is there watching Jesus die. I mean, talk about being in a situation where you think, this hope has disappointed me. I had hope. I believed that things would be better. And then a few days later, when she goes to the tomb, she and Jesus' mom and Jesus' aunt, they go to the tomb because they're going to put spices on Jesus' body, which is part of the Jewish traditions. And when she gets there, the tomb is empty. Now, they don't go like, whoa, Jesus came back to life. This is not what they're thinking. They're not expecting that. They see that the tomb is empty and they look at each other and they say, what happened? Someone took his body. is this ever, like, it just keeps getting worse, right? First he died and now they've stolen his body. There is no good coming. And so everyone else has left and Mary is still standing there. She's in this garden near the tomb and she's weeping. And when I think of her, I think she has lost all hope. Jesus was the first person, I really think, Jesus was the first person who saw value and dignity in her. He transformed her. And now, he's left her. Maybe you can relate to this feeling. We're going to pick the story up in John chapter 20, verse 11. Mary, that's Mary Magdalene, was standing outside the tomb crying. And as she wept, she stooped and looked in. She saw two white-robed angels, one sitting at the head and the other at the foot of the place where the body of Jesus had been lying. "Dear woman, why are you crying?" the angels asked her. "Because they have taken away my Lord," she replied. "And I don't know where they have put him." Now, I think even that is remarkable, okay? Like, she's got two angels talking to her, and her hopelessness is so deep and real that she doesn't, like, acknowledge, like, oh, there are angels here. Like, maybe something good is happening. The despair is real. "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have put him." Verse 14, she turned to leave and saw someone standing there. It was Jesus, but she didn't recognize him. "Dear woman, why are you crying?" Jesus asked her. "Who are you looking for?" She thought he was the gardener. "Sir," she said, "if you've taken him away, tell me where you have put him and I will go get him." "Mary," Jesus said. She turned to him and cried out, "Rabboni," which is Hebrew for teacher. "Don't cling to me," Jesus said, "for I haven't yet ascended to the Father. But go and find my brothers and tell them I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene found the disciples and told them, "I have seen the Lord." Then she gave them his message. Mary is in this place that feels completely hopeless. And Jesus comes and finds her. Appears to her, speaks to her, says her name. And this a friend of mine, as we talk about this story, a friend of mine likes to say, for a period of time, the Christian church consisted of one woman weeping in a garden. She's the only one who knows. She's the only one who knows that Jesus has resurrected. She's the only one who knows hope is not dead. What an unlikely candidate. A woman who used to be possessed by demons, who is in a place where she feels utter despair, is given a spark of hope. I want to read you something that theologian Jürgen Moltmann says. Jürgen Moltmann is a German theologian who, he actually fought in World War II. He was drafted into the German army at 18 and was a prisoner of war and spent most of the rest of the war in war camps. And while he was in these camps, he became aware of the atrocities that his nation was committing. He saw pictures of Auschwitz and some other concentration camps. And he began to experience that kind of hopelessness and despair. "How could I ever go to my home country," he said, "when I know what we have done?" And while he was in one of these camps, someone gave him a copy of the Psalms and the Gospels, and he read these stories, and he later said, "I did not find Jesus. Jesus found me." And when he came out of World War II, he committed his life to Christ and began to write quite a bit about hope. Because he had seen the depths of hopelessness, but also began to understand what it meant to find Christ's hope in these ugly, ugly places. And here's what he says. "Isn't this the essence of the gospel? God, the eternal, infinite God, is so close to you that he loves you and in his love accepts you just as you are. People who feel the faintest spark of this love become conscious of their own dignity. They get up, they walk upright, and they live with their heads held high. The love founded on this hope is the strongest medicine against the spreading sickness of resignation." How do we find this hope? We must remember that our hope exists because our Jesus is faithful. We must remember that our hope is based not on the strength of our convictions, but it's based on the strength of our Christ. My hope is not found in the things that I wish for and the things that I'm wanting and the things that I'm waiting for. Because if I'm being honest with you, the strength of my wishes, my wants, my desires, they ebb and flow. There are some days where I wake up and I think like, yes, Jesus. And there are other days where I wake up and I think like, ugh, I can't. I have no desire for him. But this doesn't change my hope, because my hope is founded on the fact that my Jesus wants me and he is waiting for me, just like he did with Mary Magdalene in the garden. He looked for her. He found her. He saw her. He spoke her name. He let her see the beauty of who he was and the fact that hope was not dead. Literally, hope had resurrected. My hope is based on Jesus, on his sacrifice for me and his resurrection for me. And Paul emphasizes this to just read the last few verses in this section in Romans chapter 5. Verse 5 says, this hope will not lead to disappointment. And then verse 6 says, when we were utterly helpless, Christ came at just the right time and died for us sinners. Now, most people would not be willing to die for an upright person, though someone might perhaps be willing to die for a person who is especially good. But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die while we were still sinners. This is the basis of my hope. Christ's sacrifice for me. And that does not ever change. His sacrifice for you, his desire for you.